Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. I have a very special episode for you guys today. I was just telling Amanda before we started that I had no idea that she had so much going on a few weeks ago when I reached out. Yeah, so I was, we kind of accidentally got into doing this whole series on interrogation techniques and false confessions. And doing some of my research, I went onto the Labyrinth's podcast feed and found Amanda and her husband Christopher's 6-part series that they did on interrogation techniques and false confessions, really on false confessions, and was enthralled by it. So I reached out to Amanda, didn't realize that you're all over the place, because not only did you guys do that, I just realized that you had written a new book called Free, My Search for Meaning. And then I read that whole book, and then I finished the book, and then saw I feel like the internet is tracking what I'm doing, because then the first thing I saw was a trailer for a new Hulu series coming out, The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox, which is the first, all the documentaries and docuseries that have been out there about your story. This appears to be the first one where you get to tell the story.
That is correct. Yes, it's very exciting, very new. And I think, you know, something that Hollywood is taking a chance on, because someone in my position is typically not put in the position of executive producer of their own story. So I think it's a potentially the sign of like something, some big rethinking happening in Hollywood when it comes to telling the stories of real people.
I hope so. And I'm super excited for it. So we're going to start off on this first bit. I want to talk about what I originally contacted you for, which was the false confession series, because I obviously haven't seen the Hulu series yet, but between the book and the series you guys did on Labyrinths, I mean, you guys are just doing such incredible work. This is the False Confessions 6-part series, which started, I think, was it back in December or so, November, December, when you guys
when we released
that?
It. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is by far and away. And I say this as someone who just has done a series on false confessions, interrogation techniques. Your guys's series was by far and away the best, most informative series that I've ever had on it. And I've been directing my listeners to go to, because we do several cases that involve false confessions over the years. It's always the biggest hurdle for people to get past, even people who are very much, you know, innocence minded and wrongful conviction minded. It's still really hard to get past someone who has confessed to a crime. You guys just, the way you guys laid it out, and that's kind of the first thing I want to talk about, is how did you guys come up with the methodology to lay this out in the 6 parts? Because you went through the history of, you know, how interrogation techniques started. And then the different ways they break you down, the physical aspect, the psychological aspect. You did a whole episode breaking down how the Reed technique works, which is a big focus that we've had. So can you kind of talk about that process? Like, how did you guys put this thing together?
Yeah, you know, first of all, thank you for the compliment. The series about false confessions was really a long time coming, because most of the advocacy work that I do now as a criminal justice reform advocate is centered on specifically police interrogations and interrogation techniques, precisely because I lived the consequences of, like, I have very lived experience of the consequences of that. And
right.
and I completely understand how, like, I've seen with my own eyes how a very clear case of a wrongful conviction still faces incredible hurdles merely because of a false confession. And even a false confession that makes zero sense whatsoever. There is just like there's something about a confession that makes people reticent to believe in the innocence of the person. And just, you know, in flying in the face of all like physical, you know, impossibilities and, you know, in common sense, it just like there's something about it. And for me, when I was tackling this issue of why is it that people, like, unless you've gone through it yourself, why is there this reticence to believe that someone could be coerced into implicating themselves and others in a crime that they have nothing to do with? And especially because, like, now as a person who's living, you know, living my life and going on with my life, I've survived this experience, I've come out of it. I see like little versions of false confessions that we all make every day where, you know, someone may accuse you of having said something with the wrong tone, you know, or like saying, oh, you forgot to put this away. And you're like, I'm pretty sure I did put that away, but okay, whatever. Sure, I forgot to put away. Like, there are all these little ways that we falsely confess every day. And yet there is still this reticence to believe that someone would falsely confess to something that has such dire consequences. And I think one of the things that's really surprising is that when you do look at wrongful convictions and when false confessions happen in wrongful convictions, you might think, common sense might make you think, that someone would be more willing to falsely confess to a lesser crime, like, say, you know, like theft or something like that. And, you know, there is reason to believe that there may be some truth to that because we have such like high, you know, rates of people just not even going to trial, just saying, I'm going to take a plea deal.
Yeah.
But like when you look at like a case of, say, you know, armed robbery versus murder, you see in wrongful conviction cases, by far, people are wrongly, like falsely confessing to murder way more than they are falsely confessing to something like an armed robbery, which is interesting because you would think that because it is murder, you would not want to falsely confess. You would do everything you could to possibly not falsely confess because of the consequences being so dire. But I think that that just goes to show that there is something happening in the interrogation room, and particularly in cases of murder, where there is a lot of pressure being put on an innocent person that is coercing them and that is putting them in a position where they feel like the only way out is a false confession. And trying to get people to like get into the mindset of someone who's in that place, sort of, I felt like I had to sort of hold their hand and think back, even for myself, to understand it, like, well, what is even our relationship with confession, right? It's not just something that happens in an interrogation room. Like, prior to police investigations, even, people were confessing in a spiritual and a religious context. And I wondered if there was maybe some aspect of that, like the spiritual and the religious context, that was imbuing the false confession in an interrogation room with some kind of sense of legitimacy or validity that otherwise, like if it were considered just like any other piece of, you know, false evidence, like a bite mark, for instance, people are now willing to acknowledge that like a bite mark is not the signature of a killer. Like that's not, that's just, you know, that's junk science. Whereas once we used to think it was, like there's something about the confession of it that really sticks to people and makes them think there's no way an innocent person would say something unless they felt guilty. And if they feel guilty, there must be a reason why. And I think the thing that I really wanted to show was, first of all, that historical background, and also how in the course, and this is a little bit inspired by how we approached another series that we did called Blood Money, where we looked at the history and ethics of true crime journalism. So we were interested, again, in that, like, okay, here we are today. with the question of journalism and how we treat this, the, you know, the horrible things that happen in real life and how we tell stories about them. This is where we are today, but how did we get here? And so that's a similar approach that I took with false confessions and into police interrogation techniques. So I went back in time and I said, well, how have we done confessions in the past? And how did police obtain confessions in the past? And how important were they to investigations in the past? And, you know, before the, you know, advent of DNA, where there was this like this solid proof, like you, it, this is like the, it's the most proofy proof we have, DNA, right? Like,
right.
It's you can't fake DNA, right? There was something about the confession that allowed people to feel okay administering justice, right? Like there was a point when there was a point in our, you know, history of, you know, criminal justice where you couldn't execute a person until they confessed, right? Like that's really interesting, right? Like we could, unless the person confessed to the crime, there was always some kind of lingering doubt. And there, and also there was the question of, you know, how is their soul? Like they need that part of the process of justice is the person who committed the crime repenting so that their soul might be saved, even though their body faces the human consequences of their actions. And so like there's, again, there's this like deep, there's this imbuing of like this deep spiritual meaning. And it goes to the spiritual idea of what justice means that the confession is imbued with. So much importance has been put on the confession and obtaining that confession to prove the guilt of the individual who is accused. And that has then carried forward in time as we have discovered new forms of evidence. But like the most convincing and quickest way to obtain that sense of proof of guilt has been through obtaining confession. And I think that the ways that that has evolved in time, the ways that we have obtained those confessions has warped over time or evolved over time in recognition of the fact that coercion is possible. Like people used to torture people to and into confessing before they, you know, before the state decided to kill them. Now they torture them, not physically, but psychologically. And there are, I think that's that sort of shift happening is one in which I would love to see more acknowledgement of like how deeply coercive psychological manipulation and psychological torture is. Because I think people don't really, people acknowledge that when it comes to things like abusive relationships or like gaslighting between other human beings. But for some reason, there's resistance to the idea that a suspect in an interrogation room who is faced with an, a, you know, a legal authority figure cannot be manipulated or psychologically coerced, or maybe they're thinking there's some kind of mutual manipulation happening, when really when it all comes down to it is there's a one individual sitting across the table from another and one person has all of the power over another.
Yeah.
Like the person who's being interrogated does not have control over what is happening in that interrogation room. And I think that is a myth that I would love to change, because I think that, you know, when we think about interrogations and police procedurals, they make it out like it's sort of like a cat and mouse game, like who's playing who in the interrogation room. And it's like, no. That's not what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
There is an authority figure who has all of the power in the room. And especially when you're faced with an innocent person who has every reason to believe that they are on the side of the police officer and is somehow confronted with they enter into that conversation with an authority figure with a certain kind of expectation that then makes them even more vulnerable to coercion. Like, I think that is something that to this day, police officers and law enforcement professionals are really resistant to acknowledging alongside the general public. I've just thrown a lot at you because this is like something that I think a lot about, which is why it required 6 whole episodes to really like, just like, let me break it down for you. Like, here's what happened in the past. Here is how it evolved to today. This is how it works today. This is what it feels like to go through this interrogation. these are the long, like, these are the consequences that go on into time. Like, even after the person is proven to be innocent, like, the psychological damage that is done to an individual who has been coerced into falsely confessing. Like, there's so, like, it's such a big topic if you just look closely, basically. Yeah.
The thing is, there's so much. I was taking notes while you were talking about the.
I know
things.
You were like, ah.
No, it was great. I didn't want to interrupt you, but I want to a couple things. One is kind of started one of the things you said towards the end. I think that evolution is where law enforcement found the sweet spot to where people like know. So when they were. And in the series, you go through like everything from like the old religious place where it began. And then you talk about, you know, the torture they would use to physically beat confessions out of everybody. And it was like when they evolved from, okay, we're not going to physically beat people anymore. Now we're going to move into psychological warfare. Mm-hmm. That was the place where it seems to me where people, again, even innocent minded people, or like, well, they didn't beat it out of them. Like,
right.
I think
they
people
didn't
have
leave a mark. I can't see, you know, the physical damage to this person. Psychological damage is much harder to prove.
Well, and it's harder for people to understand, because I hear it all the time, even with, you know, people that I work with, friends, family, people that like fully understand that false confessions do happen, you know, on at least at the surface level, and that wrongful convictions certainly happen. You know, you always hear the same thing. Like, I would never, never say I killed somebody when I didn't. That's ridiculous. And it's so hard for people to wrap their brain around how that psychological warfare happens, how they break you down. It's torture to get you to that place. And I want to kind of take you to that moment, because I find it. This is a thing that I talk about a lot in kind of in theory, but you lived it.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. Social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
For those of you that don't know, Amanda, in her case, was it 53 hours of interrogation? Later, eventually, they wrote out a confession for you. Yep. You signed it.
This is when I was in Italy studying abroad. So I was being interrogated in a foreign language without an attorney in the immediacy after in the wake of discovering that one of my roommates had been murdered. Yes.
Right. And we learn in your book that, you know, kind of what was going through your mind. But if you could talk about that idea that you didn't think, because, and this is the part that it's always abstract I'm talking about, it that they you don't understand. People will do the confession because they want to get it over with, and they think, and I think in people's minds are like, what do you mean over with? And when they confess, they're going to prison for the rest of their life. So if you can talk a little bit about like that moment, because like I said, in your book we learned like you didn't think when you signed that confession that meant you were going to prison.
Yes. So this is one of the techniques that police will employ in interrogations. And there's a number of different techniques that is employed. But one of them is is what the experts now call minimization. So what they'll do is they'll try to convince you that, first of all, everything you think you know to be true is wrong. So there's this, first of all, this element of like gaslighting, like they lie to you, they give you false information that then sort of in the pressure cooker of the interrogation causes you to question your own understanding of reality, like your own, like what was communicated to me, for instance, is that everything I thought I remembered about the night that the murder happened, that I was staying the night at my boyfriend's house, that we were watching a movie, that we had dinner. Like I had all of these very vivid memories of what I was actually doing that night.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me that they had 100% proof that that was wrong, that they had physical proof that showed that I was at my house, not at my boyfriend's house, the night that the crime occurred. And that what that meant was that my mind, like I had must have witnessed something so horrible that my mind not just blacked it out, but made up memories to cover up for the horrific thing that I must have experienced. So now they're lying to me. They're introducing a new reality to me, but they are also justifying that new reality with an explanation that I can maybe sort of get behind, like, oh, I've never, like, yes, I'm now in a traumatic situation, like my roommate's just been murdered. They call this in psychological terms the cognitive opening, right? Like and you actually see this in when people study extremism and how people are turned from regular everyday people into terrorists, is they say very often they target people who have just experienced something very traumatic. So like someone close to them dying, like that experience makes someone feel a little bit unsteady with the world. Like they're just going about their day and all of a sudden someone close to them dies. At that moment in their life, they are psychologically experiencing what is called a cognitive opening, when the world as they knew it is under question. And so now, in that pressure cooker of an interrogation room where I've already been cognitively opened by the fact that my roommate just was suddenly murdered for no reason, I'm given this new information that makes me question my own reality, makes me question my own sanity, and then introduces new information that I want to grasp onto because I'm motivated to grasp onto because here are these authority figures that I am now relying on for my own safety. Like, you know, there's a murderer on the loose and I'm scared. I don't know what to do. I'm calling police officers for help. I was the one who called the police for help. I reach out to them and I'm leaning on them. And in response, they are giving me certain kinds of behavioral cues about what they are looking from me. So when I say I was at my boyfriend's house, they get mad at me. They yell at me. They hit me. When they suggest to me, oh, you were at the house and you witnessed something terrible and you don't remember it. And I say, well, maybe that's true. Suddenly I'm given a lot of like support and like hand holding and it's going to be OK. And you just need to remember the truth. Try to remember the truth. So there's a lot of like psychological game playing here where on the one hand, they're beating you with the stick. On the other hand, they're, you know, holding out the carrot, which is this new reality that they are suggesting to you. And the minimization then comes in where they say, you didn't, you know, they're not accusing you of committing the crime. They're accusing you of having witnessed it, of having been present, which of course implicates yourself in the crime. Or in the case of a really famous example from like Making a Murderer, Brendan Dassey, who is this like kid who is 17 years old, has a mental handicap, who is coaxed into a false confession by police officers who are saying, oh, you didn't mean to, or, you know, you were just doing what your uncle told you. Like there's a lot of like minimization to make them think, oh, what you did, what we're telling you did and what we're asking you to imagine that you did isn't making you the bad guy. In fact, if you just come clean and tell us this thing, you're going to be okay. You're on the good guy side again. So it's again that like carrot that they're holding out to you. And so you're trying to grasp onto any kind of like solidity and reassurance. And this is the assurance that they're giving you. And again, after causing you to question your own sanity, to question your own memories. And so you're grasping for anything that's going to make you feel okay, to make you feel secure, to make you feel like you're on the side of the good guys, that they're not mad at you. And you end up being coaxed and coerced into this new story, this new narrative that either you are accepting because you're just so beaten down and exhausted that you just want to just tell them whatever they want to hear to make the whole thing stop, or because you've genuinely sort of absorbed this new story and you're questioning your own reality. In my case, I was questioned for a long time. I was up through the night. I had already been psychologically traumatized by my roommate just being dead all of a sudden. I started to believe them. And I started to try to force myself to imagine an alternate reality, which they were suggesting to me, which was that I had gone out that night, I had met my boss, Patrick, and that he had murdered my roommate and that I had somehow witnessed it. And what really was so scary about it was that it felt like at a certain point, I did not know what the truth was anymore. Like, again, I had very vivid memories of being with my boyfriend the entire night. But then they're asking me to imagine new memories. And these new memories were not like the memories that I had of the actual night. Like, they weren't my actual memories. They were more like snapshots. And they were snapshots of actual memories. So like for me, again, this is for me, I had a snapshot image of, you know, the basketball court that was outside, like basically between my boyfriend's house and my house, there was a basketball court. Mm-hmm. And so I had a snapshot of the basketball court because that was on the way back to my house. And I had a snapshot image of my boss wearing his, you know, brown leather jacket. And then I had a snapshot of me sitting in my living room, but I didn't have an actual memory of my boss being there, of him murdering my roommate. Like I had zero actual memory of this, but I was trying to piece together from other memories, from other days,
yeah,
what this supposed memory was. And that was all I was able to come up with. But that was what I delivered to the police in response to their suggestions. They wrote it all up in this little cozy little narrative. And then it was done. And then it was, and then there was nothing I could do after that. As soon as I signed that paperwork, there was it was over for me, right? Like,
right.
To this day, I remain wrongly convicted in Italy for what they call criminal slander, where they say I knowingly and willingly accused an innocent man of a crime that I had witnessed and knew him to be innocent of, which is obscene. But like, right. To this day, people cannot wrap their mind around the idea that I could have been coaxed and coerced into imagining something that the police were presenting to me as the only way, as the only truth, the only acceptable truth.
And that's one of the ways that psychological breakdown happens too, like right out of the textbook, is they will never accept. And you talked about this in your book, how they will not accept that you didn't do it. Any suggestion you make that you didn't do it, they blow it off as that's off the table now.
Right.
Like the idea that you didn't do this is not a possibility. So stop it. We're going to talk right. about why you did it.
We're going to punish you for even continuing to suggest that. Yes.
Right.
Like that's the stick element of it. You're repeating what you know to be true. And they are conveying to you that that is wrong. They will not accept that. And we are only going to continue this conversation. Like, the only way for you to have a good ending to this conversation is to stop, you know, telling the truth and tell us what we want to hear.
Right.
And it's terrifying, because during that period of time, during the interrogation, you feel like you're going crazy. Like, why are these authority figures not believing me? Like, I'm telling the truth. There's no other thing that I can tell them. And you just feel trapped because like you literally have nothing else to give. You're repeating the same things over and over and over again. And then comes the nitpicking of that reality that you're trying to convey, where they say, well, that can't be true because you said, you know, previously that you had dinner at, you know, 8, and now you're saying it may have been 8:30. You know, clearly you're lying. Like, there's this, like, this nitpicking of your reality so that you, that to sort of demonstrate that it's unacceptable. And then they come in with the alternative reality and the lies and the coaxing and the coercing of you to accept that new reality that they are presenting to you.
And then when it wrapped up and you signed off on it, is like you talked about in the book, that you thought
yes,
that was the end of it and you were going to go home. Like, how did they convince you that you, when you just essentially assigned a confession that says that you participated or part of a murder, but you in your, and again, jumping back to like the Brendan Dassey example.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I feel like people will wrap their brain around that. It's very clear he has a cognitive handicap, that there's something there. It's like, oh, he's young. He has a lower IQ. He's got, like, I can see how that happened. But you were 20 years old.
Overachieving exchange student.
Yeah.
You know, I did very well in school. I did not have a cognitive disability at all. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the reasons why I'm a big advocate for this, because I think a lot of people are willing to accept the idea that minors or people who are cognitively challenged are going to be the ones who falsely confess, but a regular human being wouldn't falsely confess. And it's
right.
Like, nope. I was technically an adult. And I did not have a mental handicap, and I was coerced into falsely confessing. And so, yes, I came out of that interaction with the police believing that I was a witness to a crime, because that was what the police told me. And the police said that they were going, again, it's all the lies. Like, this is the lies that were presented to me. So the police tell me that now that I have, you know, told them the truth, I've remembered the truth, I'm now on the good side, they're going to take care of me, they're going to take me somewhere where I can be protected. Like, that's what they told me. They're, we're mm-hmm. taking you to a place where, for your own protection, now that you are a witness. And I'm trying, now I'm imagining myself having to go up on a stand in front of a court of law and point the finger at my boss. And as I'm sort of coming out of this, like, psychological haze, I'm realizing, oh my God, I don't have any memories of this man murdering my roommate. I can't, you know, I can't go up on a stand and testify against him. I'm trying to tell that to the police, but they say, no, 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 your true memories will return with time. You just need to wait. So, you know, I'm coming out of that, and they bring me into they put handcuffs on me, and they say, we're so sorry, we have to put handcuffs on you. It's just a formality. We're taking you to a place for your own protection. So I had all of the information that I was obtaining from the police that they were communicating to me was that I was not in trouble, that I was on this, I was just a witness. I was not being accused of this crime. I was never read my rights. Like, I was never told that I am a suspect. I was never accused. I was just put into a police car and brought to the prison, which I didn't even know was the prison. And I was brought to a cell, and I was told that I wasn't allowed to speak to anybody. And it wasn't until days later, when I was finally brought in front of a judge and formally told, you are hereby accused of the murder of Meredith Kircher, that I just sat back in shock. And I looked over at the police officers who were there during my interrogation, my jaw gaping, like, oh my God, how have I been so had? Like, how was I so tricked? They just lied to me. And I, like, even days into imprisonment, I thought that I was just a witness. And I had been completely lied to. And I was shocked. So again, like, shock upon shock upon shock.
Was there ever a moment where you look back on it and thought, like, how did I believe that? You know, because that's the thing, is where you look back, like, once you're out of it and you've had some time to think, because I feel like that's how people, like, look back on situations where they're like, why would she believe she just signed a confession? Why would she think she wasn't going to prison? Of course she was going to prison. Did you, like, ever, or wasn't, like, in court, that's when it was like, that's it? And then was there a time when you were like, yeah, obviously, why didn't it occur to me then? Because there had to come up time when you started to, like, process Like, the why did I do all of that? Like, why did I sign it to begin with? Why did I think that this wasn't happening once you're away from it for a little bit?
Yeah. And I mean, this is something I go into the series as well, which is like the psychological damage and the psychological consequences of this. So for years, I did not understand what happened to me. I was sitting there in prison, being called not just a murderer, but like a malicious liar, and being blamed for the outcome of my own interrogation. And I did not have the language or the understanding of like psychological coercion and, you know, psychological torture that I do today.
Right.
I instead just felt like utterly helpless and so confused. And part of me was like, it wasn't my fault. Was it because I didn't speak Italian well enough? Was it because I, really did get confused? Like, how could I get so confused? And the one thing that I regret is how much I hated myself for so long because of what happened. Because it was not my fault. It was not. But like, try telling that to a 22-year-old kid who's just been sentenced to 26 years in prison, and everyone the world over does not believe her and accuses her of being a malicious, murdering liar. Even after I was acquitted and I came home, so many people were, you know, even the ones, like, I had an outrageous conversation with somebody who was trying to be all, you know, progressive and like understanding of false confessions. And he was like, well, do you think that you lied because you were just, you know, did you lie and falsely accuse someone because you thought, well, he's a black guy, so they'll just believe that he's the killer and I'll just get off the hook? And I was just like, oh my God. Like, even you, somebody who is like trying to be like progressive and understanding of like what is really going on in interrogation rooms, like, has no fucking clue about what is actually happening in the mind of a person who is being psychologically tortured. The only reason why my boss even came into the conversation was because I had been texting him the night of the murder. I was supposed to go into work, but then he said it was too slow, so don't come into work. So like, of the people who could, like, the only reason why he ended up getting brought into the whole scenario was because he was one of the people who could confirm my alibi. There was my boyfriend, Raffaele, and my boss, Patrick. They could confirm my alibi. And so they were the ones who were thrown under the bus with me. They were the ones who the police sort of pinpointed because they were the ones who were connected to me. And it had absolutely nothing to do with, you know, him being a black man or not. It was because he had been text messaging me. And that was the reason why the police got fixated on him. And so just the idea that like any part of what happened was a choice. I was not given a choice. I was presented with an opportunity where, as a young person who had been recently traumatized, was now being, on the one hand, beaten with a stick and on the other hand, coaxed with a carrot, and was delivered this new reality and had like all of these lies reshaping my understanding of my own sanity. Like, I was not a voluntary, willing, and capable participant in that interrogation process. And in fact, the interrogation process was specifically designed to make me incapable of having any kind of voluntary action in that moment.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
Moro Casino, America. Moca Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
That's the thing that I feel like is not understood about interrogations, is like how that psychological torture can break down the capacity for a person to knowingly and willingly intend to do anything when at a certain point you don't even understand what is true or not anymore.
I think this is a perfect spot for me to transition into when you were talking about the long-lasting effects and things like that. I don't even remember the last time we talked. I had you and Christopher on in 2020, and we talked about
a second, yeah,
yeah. and at that point, you talked about how you still had all of the, you know, the hate and vitriol you still get from social media. That, you know, how dare you live your life when Meredith that doesn't have hers anymore? There was a lot of that going on, mm-hmm. And it seemed like it was a pivotal moment in your life when we talked, where you were ready to just take your life back and start mm-hmm. living it. You were talking about starting a family and all the things that were going on at that time. And so like my favorite part of reading the book was to hear how you have absolutely done that. I mean, you go through the story of what was happening to you then, but then we hear in your book what you've been doing since then. You know, you guys did start a family, you have mm-hmm. children, you kind of finally were like, I'm taking it back. So it's been a really cool transformation for me to watch, to see from where you were at in 2020 to now 5 years later, like where you're at, how you're just taking control of things. So I'll let you, I've already keeping you longer than I intended to, but if you can talk about just a little bit, you know, what people can expect from the book. I can tell you for that was my perspective, was you're hearing everything that happened to you then, but then you're really hearing the process and the stories mm-hmm. of you like reconnecting with the prosecutor.
Yes, yeah.
Was just incredible.
Yeah, and it's an ongoing process to this day, but like, yes. So between 2020 and 2025, you know, I've accomplished quite a lot. I have a husband, I have a family, I have two beautiful kids, I have a career, I am very comfortable having reclaimed my story and reclaimed my sense of agency in my story. And so recognizing where I did have agency versus where I didn't, and feeling and learning to like articulate what this experience was for me and what are those long ongoing consequences. One of the goals of my book was to describe how just like finally being, you know, freed and released back into the free world did not mean that I felt free, because I was still, you know, branded the girl accused of murder, the girl, you know, convicted of maliciously slandering somebody because of her interrogation. And so bearing, you know, entering a world that seemed to be poised to see the worst in me, and to view me in the worst possible light, and to constantly find myself in conversation with the worst experiences that I'd ever gone through, knowing that those things were in a big way, not just defining for me, like personally, like, yes, you know, having gone through that experience was a really defining developmental period of my life, but also just like when people think of me, they think of my friend's murder. Like, they don't think of things that I've accomplished or that I've done. They think of the fact that, you know, like they think about some girl being murdered, like raped and murdered, and I had nothing to do with it. So how do I make sense of that? And part of it was talking about how I failed and over again to be okay. And that was a really important part of me writing it, because I feel like a lot of times when you hear stories of wrongful convictions, they tell the story all the way up until they get out of prison. And then they have their little hamburger moment when they eat their first McDonald's hamburger after they get out of prison. And then it's curtains down, you know, the end. Yay, yay. Everyone's happy again. And it's like, no. That's when that person's life really starts, because suddenly they are no longer proving their innocence in a court of law. They're sort of forever proving their innocence just in the court of public opinion. But let's put that aside. Just like being a person again and trying to make a sense of like who they are and processing that experience. And one thing that I talk about is how, you know, the experience of grief you don't ever just like move on from something like this. Like it forever is a lens of experience through which you view everything else that comes at you in your life. Like I talk about in the book when I had my daughter, and how like one of the first things that I felt when my daughter was born was dread that she was going to have to, like, this dark shadow that had been like hanging over me was going to inadvertently pass that on to her, and that she was going to be living in the shadow of the worst experience of my life. And so like the fact that like these traumas continue to be processed through the rest of our life, and we're trying to make sense of it, and we can fall into a trap of feeling like utterly debilitated by it, is a very deeply felt experience. And then I talk about how I found a way out of that trap. And the way out of that trap was inadvertently by going right back in, which was staring into the face, literally, of the man who sent me to prison, and confronting him not just with a position of you were wrong and you harmed me and that was wrong, like that was bad, but also from this place of like, but I don't want to be your adversary. You and me have been in this adversarial system, this adversarial justice system, our entire existence together, and I'm fucking sick of it. I want to find common ground. Can we find common ground? Can we understand each other? Can I accept you as who you are? And can you accept me as who I really am? And what happens when we do that? And I think that, you know, the outcome of all of that was extremely satisfactory to me. But also there's this very important character in the book, which is my mom, who has always been a huge support and like safety net for me, who confronted me with how unsatisfactory the whole experience was for her. And like, and both of those, both of our perspectives of what the ultimate outcome of that conversation with my prosecutor was were valid, I think is so interesting. But ultimately, the sort of like the getting out of the feeling trapped is realizing that like, it really goes down to that, those like ancient wisdoms of, I can't let my well-being and my life hinge upon my prosecutor waking up one day and thinking, you know, I may have been a bit overzealous, you know, I can't let my agency and my ability to live a meaningful life depend upon another human being. I need to be able to stand up for what I believe in and for what my principles are, regardless of what other people around me do in response. And I think that was the true like reckoning with freedom that I came to in the end of the book, which is really concerned about this question. It's why it's called Free. Like, what does it mean to be free? Am I free if my prosecutor doesn't acknowledge he made a mistake? Like, on the one hand, you could say, no, I'm still sort of caught in the web of the lies. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I might say, yeah, because it doesn't fucking matter what he thinks. You know? And so like, that's that interesting tension and that interesting conversation that I have with myself and my loved ones and with the audience, because like my challenge to the audience is to imagine a life where they can be free. Cause I know that, you know, my circumstances are pretty uncommon, but you know, more common than you'd like to think. But like most people who are reading my book are not going to be victims of, you know, false confessions and wrongful convictions, but they are people who may feel trapped in their own life for whatever reason. And so my sort of challenge or question for the audience who's reading is to ask themselves, what does it really mean to be free? And have you ever really asked yourself that question? I was forced to ask that question because I had my freedom taken away from me, but I feel like there's potentially this lingering sense of unease with the universe that we might feel because we don't feel like we are genuinely in charge of our own lives. We're not genuinely free to act the way that we would want to or live the life that we think we should be living. And I think that's a really interesting universal human dilemma.
And that's one of the things that I love so much about the way you wrote it. And I actually I'm glad I did it this way. So I started reading the book and I got about halfway through it. And then I had a whole bunch of yard work to do. So I
just to process.
I couldn't put it down, but I had shit to do. So I downloaded the audiobook and I listened to the second half.
Oh, cool.
I
read it.
Yeah. So it was with your voice reading it. It was like, I feel like I almost want to go back and do the whole thing all over again because I feel like hearing you read the words was even more impactful than reading them, particularly at the end. And I think that the whole book is like you said, it's inspiring. It's not a true crime story. It's your story, but it's so much more inspiring for anyone, I think, and the way you close it. And also the fact that, you know, there are times in the book when you're reading the book when you can hear emotion in your voice coming through, which that was kind of, it caught me off guard and what choked me up when I was on the lawnmower. It was just like,
yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, there are some parts that just still fuck me up, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm still grieving, like actively grieving, and you can hear it.
Yeah. Did you have, this is a curious production question, the producers when you were reading it, did they want you to retake it, or they're like, no, that's fine, leave it?
So I was actually really fortunate when I read this one because the director who I worked with is also a friend of mine who was one of my first readers. So he really knew the book already very well.
Mm-hmm.
And he just knows me. And I think his instincts were always really good, which is when Amanda's like flowing, when Amanda's just like in the zone, when Amanda's feeling it, don't stop. Like, even if she stumbles over a word, just like keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the right instinct because, you know, I'm not just any old voice actor reading any old book. Like, I am the author of this book. I am reading this book. I am living this book as I am reading it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he wanted to capture that. So his instinct was to just run with it.
That's fantastic. I would recommend everybody buy the book, read half of it, and then download the audiobook and listen to the second half. Yeah, so in the last thing, just very quickly. So the August 20th, The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox premieres on Hulu. Is it a series? Is it a documentary? What can we expect? I just saw one little trailer for it and was like, oh, shit. That's going to be awesome.
Yeah. Yes, it is going to be awesome. So it is a limited series and it is scripted, meaning that there is an actress who is playing me, who is recreating the events. And it's really, really good. I'm really proud of it. It's very, very intentional. It's not just a conversation about a bad thing that happened. It is trying to ask really bigger questions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really beautifully done. And I'm so proud of everyone we're working with. I started working on this with Monica Lewinsky when she reached out to me back in 2021, was when we started working on this. And, you know, since we've connected with KJ Steinberg, who's the creator and showrunner, we're working with the Warren Littlefield Company, we're at Hulu. Like, it's just a huge and one thing I will say about it is, like, one of the things that I was not expecting upon going into all of this was how therapeutic it would be. Like, and I'll just tell you one really, really quick story, which is that, you know, they're recreating not only the events, but all the spaces, right? Like, they have all of this footage of what the real courtroom was like, what our real house was like, mm-hmm. from, like, all the crime scene, you know, videos and stuff that they took. And so they recreated everything as closely to reality as possible, up to the point of, like, the notes that were, like, handwritten on our refrigerator, you know, like that wow. level. And, like, when I walked on set, I was given the opportunity to go visit my house, which I hadn't seen since, you know, it had been turned into a, you know, a crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
And as I went in and was just sort of shocked with the reality of it, right? Like it was to the point where I was like, oh my God, those are my socks that are hanging up to dry on the rack. Mm-hmm. Like, I realized that, like, I had never had the opportunity to say goodbye. Like, goodbye to my other roommates, to that time in my life. I never got my stuff back. Like, I never got any of my stuff back.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, so I walk into my bedroom and there's all my stuff. Like, there's my laptop, there's my sleeping bag, like, everything. Because I brought my camping stuff like that. Like, I never got right. my camping stuff back. And, like, I'm just looking at it and going, there's my teapot. And I felt this, like, very strong impulse, not only to just, like, sit and meditate and, like, be in that space, but also, like, to take stuff back home with me. Because I was right. like, it's mine.
Yeah.
And they were really nice. The prop department actually put together a few things from the room that I never got to bring home from Perugia, that were now, you know, the things that I could bring home and recover from that time of my life, even though it, you know, it's technically a prop from a show, but it's like, that's my real teapot that I had that
mm-hmm.
was destroyed in the course of, you know, the investigation and all of that. So it was surprisingly therapeutic. It was like the most expensive immersive therapy I've ever had.
Right.
And I recommend it to everyone.
Yeah, everyone. Just get with Hulu. They'll set it all up for you.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So I'm gonna give my, here's your list for my audience to check out. One, definitely go to Labyrinth's feed. Everything you and Christopher do on Labyrinth is fantastic. This False Confession series is, again, the best one I've ever heard. You'll get everything from Amanda's story kind of peppered in there. You have other victims of false confession that tell their stories that get peppered in along with experts. And it's just put together in a very logical way. So check that out. Make sure you check out Amanda's book, Free, My Search for Meaning, and August 20th on Hulu, The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox.
Woohoo!
I will have that bookmarked. Can't wait to watch it. And Amanda, thanks so much for taking the time. I know you're very busy. And there's a lot of much bigger shows that wanted to talk to you. So I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
Love it. I'm happy to be back.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kay Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @TruthJusticePod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.